When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Charmed, and welcome back to Let Me Ruin Your Life with me, Serena Shahidi. Hello, how is everybody? You doing well? I hope you're doing well. I had lunch with a friend earlier. Nothing makes me feel like more of an adult than getting lunch with a friend. Isn't that a crazy thing to do? Just to get lunch with a friend? Just to be like, let's eat in the middle of the day together. Why don't we engage in that activity? I'm going to wear a neutral lipstick and we're going to see each other under sunlight. It's such a vulnerable thing because you're admitting to the other person like, okay, I want to hang out with you, not just for the sake of partying or whatever, you know, early 20s stuff. I'd like to share a meal with you. Let's get a salad and discuss where we are in our lives, and where everybody we hate isn't in their lives. And to add to the adulthood of it all, I didn't even get a drink. I had a Diet Coke, mic drop. Even though there was a pickle martini on the menu, which is a drink that I, by the way, thought I didn't think I invented it, but I thought I was like a real innovator for making it. At one point, this was like at the beginning of quarantine. I was drinking so much. I mean, this was around the time that I was mixing gin with Crystal Light, which to be fair, probably is, that's a lot more likely to be something I invented. Because a pickle martini, that's obvious. Pickle juice, olive juice, how different can they be? But I mean, just gin and Crystal Light. I'm sure there have been few souls on this planet sick enough to make that. Oh my God, I'm thinking back to, what a weird time. Do you ever think like, oh my God, coronavirus. Like it's a different world. It's a different world now from before coronavirus. And it's a very different world from spring of 2020. Like that really happened. There was a deadly virus running amok all around the planet, and everything got shut down and the world changed. And what did I do about it? I convinced myself I invented the pickle martini. That's what I did. That was my contribution to society at such a critical time. What else did I do? Okay, well, I made a different drink every night. A lot of Cosmos. That was when I started TikToking. Which I never would have done otherwise. I mean, do you remember the reputation TikTok had in like 2019? When it was still, it used to be Musical.ly, like not that far in the past. That was an embarrassing app to get on up until the coronavirus pandemic happened. Ever heard of it? And then all of a sudden our standards for living lowered so much that we thought, you know what? I'm going to download that app where teenagers dance. Just, you know, maybe to feel better about my life. I know I was still living in that illegal 9-bedroom in Tribeca in my windowless bedroom that could fit a twin bed, and it just barely fit. I remember I had this little vanity. It was like, I got it just like on Amazon. It's like this tiny, very compact vanity, but it had storage inside. So you would lift it up and then you would have the storage and you would have a mirror. But I just used it as a desk, like with storage. Because there are no desks that small, but there are vanities that you can shut. And that was how I lived. Wow. What a crazy time. Now that I have a window, I mean, just thinking about those times, it feels surreal. I can't even believe that I've gotten to the place that I've gotten. No, even though my window now faces a brick wall, I feel, in this moment, I feel amazing about my life. I feel so good about it. And you know why? It's because I was watching Sex and the City. And I guess that could go the other way, where I could feel bad about my life. Like, why am I not spending all day, every day with three of my best friends and also having an incredible career? But the fact that these women are in their 30s and carry, which I am proudly a carry, I'll tell you. I mean, I don't like commitment the same way Samantha doesn't. But before that, first and foremost, I'm a wreck. And that's what makes me carry. And that's really what makes everybody a carry. But the fact that, you know, Carrie was in her 30s, fully, like, going bankrupt for Marlboro Lights and Sam Edelman shoes. I mean, in this era now where it's like you have to be a landlord by the time you're 21, what a relief to watch a television program where people are just allowed to be a mess. Outside of high school, outside of college, outside of their early 20s. Because we all know it's not going away for any of us, so we might as well, you know, wear some heels about it. That's why my takeaway from Sex and the City isn't like, it's fun to be single in New York City with the girls. Honey, I know. Boy, am I aware of that. But, you know, you can be a mess for quite a while. Even though, obviously, life is more forgiving when you're white and thin and conventionally beautiful and you have a body that can process all those cocktails. And I'm very privileged to be in all of those positions, even though the last one is kind of dependent on if I have enough electrolytes in me. But anyway, all that to say, I did go to lunch today. Thank you guys for all the feedback that you gave me on the last episode. If you missed it, I asked what you wanted to hear from the podcast in the future. And you can still go back to the last one on Spotify and give me a response or DM me. Just let me know if you have an opinion and you haven't already expressed it to me. But thank you to everyone who helped me out with that. It definitely gave me a few more ideas. And I am probably going to change the pod just a couple of things at a time, experimenting a little bit. A couple of the things that a lot of people said that they wanted was more advice, more of a Dear Abby situation, and more recommendations. So I'm going to be doing both of these, kind of sandwiching this episode with those as the bread. And I also just want to do more of like diving into whatever I'm obsessed with at the moment, whatever I've been like falling down internet holes learning about. That was actually my original idea for this podcast was, or not this podcast, because it would have been just a completely different thing, but it was that I would fall down internet holes and each week I would go down a different one, which is something that I would still love to do, but it would require a lot of research. And also, I wanted to call that one Falling Down Holes, and that would make me sound like a pervert. But there is an internet hole that I fell down earlier this week that I will be breaking down today. And thankfully, it's something that I already knew some stuff about, so I didn't have to type more than I wanted to type. Anyway, before we get to that, I said I would do a little sandwich with advice and recommendations, so we're going to start this out with a little bit of advice, because I asked you guys on Instagram at Let Me Ruin Your Life Pod what your issues were, what your dilemmas were, what you'd like some feedback on, and I got a bunch of responses. I did say that I will be like stockpiling a lot of them, so if you replied with like, I'm bleeding out, what do I do? I'll get around to that in, maybe a few months. But let's do a couple today. The first one, this is a sticky situation. My friend has an awful wig, but she loves it. What do I say? And we've all been in this situation before. Probably on both ends, where sometimes your friend has to be like, hey, you look like shit. And sometimes you have to tell your friend, like, just because you hear about there being a neon trend does not mean that you have to participate. And it's a delicate subject, especially with women. Like men, as long as you're not like commenting on their body, you can just about say anything. Your hair looks like shit. You dress like shit. At least straight men, like, you can tell them that they need to get an entire new wardrobe as soon as possible, and they'll act like, you know, they're eating a banana, and you just told them that it would be more efficient to open it from the bottom than from the top. Which, by the way, the people who do that, what's the matter with you? Do you think I care? Unless I'm struggling to open this banana, which I never am because I don't eat bananas when they're like just yellow and green and they taste like deodorant. I eat bananas that have some brown on them because then they taste like banana and not talcum powder. If I'm not struggling, you don't have to tell me how to open a banana. Oh, this is the way monkeys do it. Okay. Monkeys do a lot of things a lot of different ways. Many of which I would not recommend. And just because they eat bananas doesn't mean that they're an expert. Just because you saw Curious George about a monkey who likes bananas, okay, you learned that from a cartoon? Are all dogs detectives now? Like Scooby-Doo? Well, some of them are. I would say no monkey is a banana expert, and I love monkeys. But they're not a banana expert. I would say some dogs probably are detectives. And that's just the way I see the world. What was I talking about? Oh, yeah, straight men, they can really take feedback when it comes to that kind of stuff very easily. With women, it's delicate. Because the way you look, it's so personal. And style is so personal. And we're told all the time that it completely expresses who you are. So if you're like, you kind of have an interesting look going on today with that frizzy lavender bob. They're going to be like, okay, I don't look great, which means I'm ugly, which means I'm worthless. And you got to get around that. As a friend who wants to be honest about their friend's wig. And how do you do it? It's simple. You tell your friend her wig is awful, kind of the same way that you tell her boyfriend is awful. Even though, honestly, I'd be a lot less direct about the wig. To be honest, that's just where my priorities are. But, you know, your friend has this boyfriend, loser, you hate him, she deserves better, and you don't want to be like, why would you like him? What's the matter with you? This is your taste? Is this who you are? You need some sense knocked into you. No, you don't say that right away. You say that after they break up. And you're like, okay, let's get to the root of this. Why did you pick him in the first place? What was going on there? And let's really evaluate and let's learn because this can never happen again. I won't let it. But in the moment, you say, you deserve better. You know, there's better out there. And you're going to find it. And you're going to deserve it. And you're going to be so happy. So the wig, you don't go, that wig is ugly. You go, wouldn't it be cool if you had a wig that was, like, different? It would be so cool if you got, like, a wig that had a lace front. So you could glue it down and then we could go dancing and you won't have to worry about it falling off. Like, you could really dance your little heart out. I think we would have so much fun. And you know what you can do as a little compliment sandwich? Do, like, I love the way you look in that cool-toned wig. You just look great in cool tones. I do wish, perhaps, that that wig wasn't from Party City. And maybe that it wasn't made out of Christmas tree tinsel. But I love that length on you. You're a lob, girl. You look great in a lob. That's just who you are. And that way she'll be like, okay, she's not just a hater. She's making suggestions. You might even want to do your research and pretend like you just coincidentally discovered something like, oh, I just came across this sale on wigs and they look really high quality. What if we went to this beauty supply store and we just tried them on for fun? Huh? What do you say? They're 30% off. So best of luck. And if that doesn't work, maybe just join her in solidarity and get a wig that's equally as bad in whatever way that her wig is bad. And then maybe when you're out together, people will look at you two and be like, okay, they're like doing a bit, right? Like, this is their thing. And they're just friends and they're having fun. Like girls do. Someone else asked, okay, this is an interesting question. Got a job interview with Bloomberg, parentheses, big finance company. Thank you. But I don't want to become a finance bro. Tips on how to not get sucked into that lifestyle. Okay. I feel like I'm the right person to ask about this because I know many people on the spectrum of finance bro who really come from all walks of life. Like, you don't even have to work in finance to be a finance bro. It's an attitude. And I can recognize that attitude from a mile away. By the way, people always tag me and stuff that talks about, like, dating finance bros, and it almost embarrasses me because that was, like, kind of a bit that I used to do where I talked about the, you know, how I would always date finance bros. And in my defense, okay, have I dated men who worked in finance? Yes, many. Have perhaps one or two been white collar criminals? It comes with the territory, right? But did I ever date a 26-year-old named Matt who lives in Murray Hill and wears a vest? No. That crosses the line for me. I like a quant at a hedge fund. That's the kind of finance bro I like. It's less bro-y because it's, you know, they just kind of like math. Anyway, how to not get sucked into that lifestyle. First of all, it depends what you're doing. You might not, like, you know, be vulnerable to that at all, depending on what your role is. If you're doing, like, back office stuff, it's probably less likely. It's when you're client-facing and going and whining and dining these investors that things might start to shift for you. By the way, I was standing on the sidewalk the other day waiting for the crosswalk, and there was this woman next to this kid, and it seemed like she was, like, babysitting the kid or something. I don't know. But the woman goes, "My job is client-facing." Do you know what that means? To the kid. You're telling a kid that your job is client-facing? What is the matter with you? That's hilarious, though. Now I'm just imagining people, like, telling children, like, "I work in strategic leadership." Do you know what that means? No, they don't, because they're a kid, and that's fake. And they know it. Anyway, depending on what you're doing, you might not necessarily get sucked into a crowd of people who are doing cocaine every night. But there's definitely a chance that eventually you're going to get a little taste of that lifestyle or that culture. Because what's the other option? Like, never going out with other people in your industry? And here's what I think is the key to not becoming that. You got to keep in mind that the most finance bro thing of all time is being like, "I'm not a finance bro. I'm not your typical dude who works in finance. Nay, nay, nay. I have a soft, poetic side." That is never true, first of all. That's never true. And even if it was true, a finance bro who reads poetry, great. Worst of both worlds, as far as men go. Oh, you wear a Patagonia vest and you're gonna lecture me on feminism? Can't wait for our date. But also, a lot of these guys, they're so separated from culture. Like, especially, I mean, the ones who grew up rich are, like, separated from culture because they never had to be interesting. And the ones who didn't probably spent a lot of time studying and all that. Oh my God, sirens, be quiet. I'm trying to teach a valuable lesson. So many of these people are so far away from culture that they think, like, reading The Alchemist puts them in literary circles. You know the people who go, "Yeah, I read. I love to read." And then it's either like How to Win Friends and Influence People, which is not reading, that's work. Okay? I'm sorry, is reading your employee code of conduct, does that count as reading? I don't know about that. Or they're doing like essentially a high school required reading list, which fair enough for some people. If you didn't get the chance to read those kinds of books in high school, yeah, do it now. It's never too late. But Just reading books for the sake of checking off a list of 100 books you have to read before you die. That is where literacy goes to die. Those lists. Why are you telling me I have to read Animal Farm before I die? I was required to read it, and it made me want to die. I mean, it's one thing to read those books when you're required to, but when you're an adult and you could choose whatever book you want, that's not going to get you excited about reading. You're just giving yourself an assignment. That's no fun. Yeah, a lot of finance bros are like that and think they're cultured for doing nothing. If you listen to this podcast, I mean, clearly, you're not uncultured. That's not happening. Which is the first reason that I'm sure you won't get sucked into this. The second reason is if you're engaging with stuff that is outside of finance bro culture, you're gonna be better at staying humble, okay? You ever meet a guy who works in finance, and the way he's talking, the cockiness, sometimes I just want to be like, it's not the 80s anymore. Like, finance is not the hot job to have. It's a good job. Like, good on you for making that salary and getting those bonuses. But, girl, you're not Charlie Sheen in Wall Street at his peak hotness. That's not you. You're just a guy at a bank, and that's fine. But it's been decades since that was the job that was, like, the coolest and made the most money. In this post, how long has it been since Black Monday? Okay, 89? Almost 35 years. Okay? Since Wall Street entered its flop era. Sex and the City is not airing anymore. Big died. Okay, died on the Peloton, and just like that, Big died. We're no longer looking for our Mr. Big who works in finance. And the way he treated Carrie, why would we? There are other guys with good hairlines in New York City, and that's a valuable lesson that I've learned. And the last thing that I'm sure you'll do is just to have friends that aren't in finance. That's perhaps the most important thing, because there is nothing sadder than a group of guys who all work in finance, who sit down and have 3 beers together and just talk about nothing but finance. I have been the one woman in that conversation, and I would have thought that it would make me angry to be like, okay, these guys are talking about something that I have no interest in. Because it wasn't anything interesting. It was like the boring details of their job, like Excel functions. I wasn't even mad at that. I was just like so saddened that like this is their lives. Like this is it. They go to work and they work and then they get off work and they go out with their work friends and they talk about work. I mean, even if you're doing something that's like creative and traditionally fun, your life still should not look like that. So hang out with people outside of your industry and don't be super defensive about working in finance and don't brag about it either. Because you know what? Ooh, you know what that reminds me of is those people who, I guess Harvard people is what you would call them. Harvard alumni. Where it's so clear that they are like, truly think that going to Harvard is the most impressive thing in the world. And it is impressive, okay? It's a good school. Whatever, I'll get out in front of that. But just because I've like heard from television shows that Harvard is a school just for smart people does not mean that I believe that. Because I have real life experience, okay? This is not Gilmore Girls. People who went to Harvard act like they're a part of the royal family. Like, there are so many of you. I mean, there are a bunch of royals, too. But there are even more Harvard alumni. And I've met both. Oh, I went to school in Boston. Yeah. I went to school, yeah, around Boston. So, I don't really want to say. I mean, what do you think is going to happen if you tell me you went to Harvard? You think steam is going to come out of my ears? And or like my panties are gonna drop to the floor. I don't care. I may not have gone to an Ivy League myself, but I have met people who have. on account of you meet many people in life. Okay? So let's all stay humble. I'm sure you will, though. Anyway, I want to get into the hole I fell down this past week, because I was watching a little film called I Married a Witch with Veronica Lake, of course. It was actually my first time watching the full movie. I had seen like half of it before, and I didn't remember why I stopped watching it, but then I rewatched it and I was like, okay, I kind of understand this time, because it's really not as good as you expect it to be. It's about a witch during the witch trials who curses, I guess, her like prosecutor for every man in his bloodline to marry the wrong woman. And then generations later, the witch comes back as Veronica Lake and seduces this man's ancestor. Not ancestor, descendant. Great premise. It's just not as fun as I would have hoped. I think maybe because it's a bit of a campy movie, and that doesn't come across in quite an exciting way when it's in black and white. And I like black and white movies, okay? I enjoy art. I enjoy old things. But I'm not giving a movie review. All that to say that while I was watching, naturally I was going through the IMDb trivia, and I discovered that Veronica Lake did not get along so well with her co-star, Frederick March, which led me into a whole sort of education about old Hollywood feuds, a handful of which I would like to discuss. They're all so juicy. God, I love old Hollywood gossip. It's much more exciting because, like, celebrities then didn't have a whole corporation doing PR for them. It was just kind of like, you know, some guy in a hat. And also, you kind of feel better about yourself learning about old Hollywood gossip because the people are dead. So it's like, I'm not hurting them, and this is history. Going on Des Moines and seeing who Chris Evans is dating, that's not history, and it never will be. History will forget that man. I mean, no offense to him, but can you name a single thing about Chris Evans? I don't know. He wore a sweater in Knives Out. There you go. That's all you need. Anyway, here's the goss. The historical goss. Let's start with the I Married a Witch feud, shall we? Okay, Veronica Lake, who was, of course, best known for her femme fatale roles and her little seductive side bang, which, by the way, I didn't know until I was Googling up a storm that she actually changed that hairstyle during the war, and women were working in the factories for war materials or whatever, and they were all copying the Veronica Lake hairstyle, and some of them are getting their hair caught in the machinery, so Veronica changed her hairstyle. So I'm on her side already, and I will continue to be on her side in this feud. Veronica Lake and Frederick March, who I'm not very familiar with. I guess he's most known for Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. They shot this movie in the 40s. I did the math. Veronica Lake was 19, okay? Let's keep that in mind. Frederick March, I actually didn't do the math on him. He was 64 or something like that. Just his hairline in that movie, and maybe he was stressed, but I think his face too. No offense to anyone who has a receding hairline, but it does age you, and he was certainly much older than her doing this movie, and honey, it showed. I would imagine he was like 50, something like that. Anyway, before they even shot the movie, Frederick had some things to say about Veronica, who was like obviously very sexy, very much a sex symbol back in the day. He called her a brainless little blonde sex pot void of any acting ability. Okay. Veronica responded by calling him a pompous poser, which is a much better one, by the way. Sex pot, please. That's nothing. Calling someone a poser is always, first of all, funny, and second of all, it's like one of the meanest things you can say. Because most people are like always trying to impress someone and simultaneously terrified that people are going to look at them as someone who's trying to impress. So good for her, pompous poser. During filming, Veronica started playing a few pranks on Frederick. For example, and we'll get to another story like this, there's one scene where he had to carry her. I believe it's the scene where she's introduced. He saves her from a fire, and he carries her out, and she hid a 40-pound weight under her dress. I don't know what that weight looked like or how it got in there, that you couldn't see it in the actual movie. But also, I think one of the cameramen or someone in the crew helped her put it up there. So I guess she wasn't the only one on set who did not care for him. She also pushed her foot repeatedly into his groin. I will say, though, Frederick is not the only one of her co-stars to dislike her. Apparently some people gave her the nickname The Bitch, okay? Especially on the set of Sullivan's Travels, when she started the movie 6 months pregnant and just did not tell anybody, just showed up on set pregnant one day. What are you gonna do? Her co-star from there, Joel McRea, was supposed to be in this movie, I Married a Witch, with her, but he said no. Life is too short to do another movie with Veronica Lake. Apparently, at one point, she punched some other co-star in the face. I don't know the context to that. To be fair, also, there are a lot of stories about Veronica turning down many men in Hollywood and facing a lot of vitriol for that. So who knows the context of this? Maybe that punch was justified. I guess also on the set of I Married a Witch, she was hard to work with, and she would show up like late and hungover. She was 19 filming this movie. Of course she showed up hungover. When I was 19, are you kidding me? I showed up to dinner hungover. What are you supposed to do at that age? If you don't want someone drinking heavily before a work day, hire someone who's 71, like Frederick. I mean, Jesus Christ. So this is a brief one, but that's the first one that got me into this hole. Also, Veronica Lake, sad upbringing. Her father died in an industrial explosion, and her mother, like, you know, maybe reeling from the loss of that, completely pushed her into show business, was very, like, stage mom, toxic, and then, I forget what her original name was, but she changed her name to Veronica Lake. It's a stage name because she was told to, but Veronica was the name of her mother, her rude mother. The cruel irony. Anyway, here is a very, perhaps the juiciest feud in Hollywood history. Bette Davis and Joan Crawford, let's discuss it. Okay, and a lot of this, because there's so much information out there about this feud, as there should be, a lot of this is taken from, I believe it was a Harper's Bazaar article that set up a timeline for the feud, which I found very helpful in my research. Anyway, okay, to set this up, this tale kind of begins in the 30s, and Joan Crawford was a star before Bette Davis was. And Joan was very well known, not just for her movies and being a movie star, but her love life. That was always being written about, and Betty didn't like that. I don't exactly know why that's relevant, because I don't know if they even knew each other at this point. It's not even clear when these two met or learned of each other's existences for the first time, but that's the situation to begin with, okay? Joan, already a star, known for her prolific love life, relatable. Betty, bitter about that. So Betty's star starts rising, and Warner Brothers was planning a publicity campaign, essentially like for Betty's stardom. This was like back in the day where everything was run by two studios, and they would just announce, like, this person's a star, and then it was true. It isn't like now where you can just, like, go viral on Instagram and get a selfie with Tana Mojo, and get invited to the Golden Globes. Okay? Different back then. So Warner Brothers was like, okay, let's release, you know, this press release. Bette Davis is a star now. Act accordingly, if you will. On that day, Joan Crawford got on those tabloids and said, I'm getting divorced. and outshone Betty Davis. Outshined? I don't know. Enter Franchotone, Betty's co-star in 1935 for the movie Dangerous. To be honest, I don't really know who this guy was outside of this feud. Never seen any of his movies. Sorry, flop. But apparently he was a sophisticated leading man, Cary Grant type. So Betty's filming with him, and she falls madly in love and just wants him so bad. I think she was actually married at the time, but it was to, like, a high school sweetheart or something. Like, it wasn't working, and it was never going to work. So what are you going to do? She falls in love with him. And then, while they're still filming, Joan swoops in and marries him. And, like, rubbed it in Betty's face, too. Like, he would come back to set covered in her lipstick, which, I mean, maybe that isn't rubbing it in her face. Maybe that was just probably before longwear lipstick. But still, Betty was heartbroken. And also, Joan later said, this is like a wild thing to say. She said Francho thought Betty was a good actress, but never thought of her as a woman. Ouch. The next year, the Oscars. Betty did not want to be there, and she also did not think that she was going to win an Oscar, so she wore like an ugly, plain navy dress. And she ended up winning. Francho got up, hugged her. Joan, cold shoulder. Cold shoulder. And Francho is like, hello, don't be rude, Joan. And she's like, okay, let me not be rude. Turns to Betty and goes, dear Betty, what a lovely frock. Wow. Wow, 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 wow. I mean, I'm on Betty's side so far. By the end of this, spoiler alert, I will be on neither side. And you'll agree, okay? A handful of years later, they have like dressing rooms right next to each other on the lot, I guess. And Joan sent some gifts and some flowers over to Betty. They were all returned. And apparently she even wrote a note that said, get off the crap. Did I write that down right? Get off the crap. Whatever. I already said, you know, she apparently said it. So I guess she apparently did, even if that was a typo, because now I'm starting the rumor that she said it. Okay, a couple years after that, Betty was the first choice for the movie Mildred Pierce, which does sound like a great part. It's like a did I kill my husband noir. Betty turns it down. Joan is like, okay, I want it. And not only did she end up in that movie, but she won an Oscar for the part that Betty turned down. She also, Joan accepted the Oscar in her bed, which is something that I had heard of before, but I didn't know why, and I still don't know why. She accepted the Oscar in her bed. She said at first it was because she had the flu, and then later she said it was because, I guess she just didn't want to be in the room because she was afraid of losing. But to be fair, Joan Crawford also just loved a publicity stunt. So it could have just been that. I mean, I'm recording this podcast from bed and nobody gives a fuck about that. So good on her for at least getting some attention in bed. Oh, not like that. I bet she did, though. In 1950, Warner Brothers wanted to do a movie with the both of them called Cage. And Betty turned it down and called it, I won't say the word she used in particular. Essentially, she called it a lesbian movie. And she didn't want to do that. No, no. Especially not with Joan, who was famously involved with both men and women. Slept with a lot of people in Hollywood, but a lot of women as well. Greta Garbo, Marilyn, allegedly, and some other people. So Betty was like, she wants me so bad in a lesbian way and in a lesbian context, and I refuse to engage in any sort of lesbianism with her. Even just doing a movie that kind of has some lesbian vibes. Because she just thought that Joan wanted her. And Joan had allegedly hinted to some friends that she had some interest in Betty. And some people even think that when Joan met Betty, she tried to make a move and Betty rejected her, which is why Joan married Franchot. I don't know if that's true. It seems like a bit of a theatrical move to pull just for someone rejecting you, but Joan Crawford was a bit of a theatrical woman. Couple years after that, another movie comes along. Not for both of them, but a little movie called The Star that was written by an ex-friend of Joan about a washed-up actress that she had known once upon a time. And Betty was cast essentially as this Joan character. She just jumped at the chance to play Joan in a movie that certainly portrayed her in an unflattering light. I don't think it was a good movie, though. But her daughter is played by Natalie Wood, so maybe I should give it a gander sometime. A decade after that movie comes Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, which is the only movie that Betty and Joan ever did together. I guess Joan convinced Betty to do it with her somehow. They play sisters who are having a sisterly rivalry, as you do. I don't have a sister, but I can only imagine. Because I have an older brother, and him and I used to play a game called Extreme Checkers that he invented, and the rules were he would throw checkers at me. And that was the game. So, you know, Betty agreed to do the movie under two conditions. She wanted to play Jane, Baby Jane, because that was the titular role, and she wanted a promise from the director that he wasn't sleeping with Joan. Because Betty was very like, oh, Joan slept her way to the top, which she may have. With the amount of people in Hollywood that she slept with, I'd imagine she got some good out of it. But Betty was like, no, 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 none of that nonsense on a set I'm going to be on. You're not allowed to sleep with Joan Crawford. So they start filming this movie and there's chaos on the set. I mean, very much like Veronica Lake playing practical jokes, very that. But on both sides, the pettiest one and the funniest one, mostly because, like, this is so innocent. So Joan was on Pepsi's board of directors. I guess her husband at the time was, like, high up on at Pepsi. So, naturally, Betty had a Coke machine installed in her dressing room. Simple, funny, not bad. Not bad at all. Another thing, there's a scene where Betty's character beats Joan's character. And Joan was like, I do not trust this woman to not actually hurt me. We're going to have to do a body double. I'm not risking it. And they did a body double, but there was one close up where they couldn't use one. So it was, you know, Joan and Betty. And Betty hit her for real, very hard. And then afterwards went, I barely touched her. Which, I mean, if they're supposed to be playing fighting sisters, honey, I call that method acting. To punch someone really hard and then go, I barely touched her. That's family. And tell me if this sounds familiar. There's another scene where Betty's character has to drag Joan's character out of bed. So obviously, Joan has to fill her pockets with rocks. Or whatever it was she did. She did some sort of thing that weighed herself down so that Betty would have a much harder time. And apparently by the end, Betty was like screaming in agony because she had back problems. Especially because not only did Joan make herself heavier, but she would do stuff to ruin takes so that Betty would just have to keep dragging her and dragging her. By the way, I don't know how this happened. Both here and in I Married a Witch, where these actors managed to weigh themselves down without it being visible on camera and without the other person noticing or being like, I'm fully carrying 200 pounds of weight and you're a size 2, what's going on? Anyway, the following year, Betty gets an Oscar nomination and Joan does not. And Joan is like, whatever, I'm getting on stage anyway. Whatever it takes. So she goes through the nominees for Best Actress, and a few of them weren't going to be able to attend. So she calls them up and goes, hey, if you win, can I accept your award on your behalf? And Anne Bancroft says yes, and she ends up winning for the Helen Keller movie, I think. I forget what it's called. Won a bunch of Oscars, though. And Betty didn't win her Oscar, so Despite the fact that she was nominated and Joan wasn't, Joan got on stage at the Oscars and Betty did not. And their final sort of interaction slash fight with each other when they were both alive, because there will continue to be bad blood, they signed on to do a different movie together, and Joan dropped out after a week and a half of filming, and they could not get her back on set. The director, I guess, even hired a private investigator to track Joan down to, like, get her back to set. She wasn't answering his calls, I guess. But alas, that did not work. And Joan Crawford died in 1977, and allegedly, nobody's really sure, but allegedly, Betty said, "You should never say bad things about the dead. You should only say good. Joan Crawford is dead. Good." Once again, it's alleged, but goddamn. That's not the end of the story, okay? This is crazy. So after Joan died, her daughter that she had adopted wrote a book called Mommy Dearest that was essentially about her mother being abusive. She said her mother was an alcoholic who hit her and, like, choked her and just completely isolated her from the world and was awful. And there were a bunch of Joan's friends in Hollywood who pushed back on this and was like, this is not true. But guess who else spoke out about it? You guessed it, Betty Davis, who suddenly was sticking up for Joan Crawford and saying, you know what? That daughter should have never written a book about her mother who kept her out of orphanages and the foster system and gave her this life. And Betty specifically says, it's like if my daughter wrote a bad book about me. Unimaginable. Honey, imagine it. Because in 1985, not long after she said that, really, her daughter came out with a book called My Mother's Keeper, calling Betty also an abusive alcoholic. Now, this book was less popular and not made into a big movie, which Mommy Dearest was. This book is also much more heavily contested. Far fewer people believe that Betty Davis was an abusive mother. We don't know either way. And I will say, for both of these books, there are a lot of people who believe it, but weirdly, Joan and Betty both have other kids who didn't write books about how abusive they were that denied that those books were true. So I don't know the truth, but that's that on Betty Davis and Joan Crawford. A wild feud that ended with some cruel irony. Another real juicy one that I had read already plenty about because, as you may know, I am a big Carrie Fisher fan. That's my girl. I love her. I love her books. And she was such a great Nepo baby. Like, she would talk about her family all the time and did not, you know, deny that that's where she came from. Understood how absurd it was, how connected her family was with Hollywood. And also did not hold back on the gossip. So, you know, among many other reasons, that's my girl. But let's talk about Carrie Fisher's mother, Debbie Reynolds, and Elizabeth Taylor. So Debbie and Elizabeth, they met during the Korean War. This was back when, like, stars would go out and entertain the troops. They met then, I guess they were, like, teenagers. Elizabeth was already further along in her career, but they were both entertainers, and they did some high school together. I don't really know what the schooling situation was for these young stars, but whatever it was, they were doing it together. So Elizabeth was more of a star first. Debbie became a star really in the early 50s, especially with Singing in the Rain. And she married Eddie Fisher, who was a crooner. I've never heard one of his songs in my life, but I guess at the peak of his career, he was about as famous as Debbie. Clearly, you know, legacy-wise, that is no longer the case, but maybe he should have tried starring in Halloween Town. So she married Eddie Fisher, despite the fact that Frank Sinatra warned her about him and said, he's a singer. Us singers, we're not faithful. And you know what? I've never dated a singer, thank God, but I'm going to go ahead and say true. A man, he's already creative. Red flag number one. You know, if he expresses himself with his voice, what else is he going to express himself with? If you know what I mean. And also singers tour. And you know what that means. But they get married. And they have their daughter, Carrie Fisher. The next year after they have her, Elizabeth Taylor marries Mike Todd, a producer. And they were so close to Elizabeth that Eddie was the best man. I mean, I guess, you know, if that's the case, they were close to Mike too. Eddie was the best man and Debbie was the maid of honor. In fact, when Debbie had another kid, a son, she named him Todd after Mike Todd. And this is where it gets very dark because about a month after Debbie has her son, Mike Todd himself was killed in a plane crash. And Debbie encouraged Eddie to go fly out and console Elizabeth Taylor. And in the words of Carrie Fisher, he ended up consoling Elizabeth Taylor with his penis. Okay? So he left Debbie about a month later to marry Elizabeth, who, by the way, was late to her own wedding. Work. Work. This betrayal and this love triangle became a huge tabloid thing. It was very Brad and Angelina and Jennifer. Like, same roles. Eddie was the cheating bastard. Elizabeth was the seductress homewrecker. And Debbie was the poor innocent girl who got wronged. And this was kind of surprising. But Debbie and Elizabeth, both from this, got a lot more famous. Because this was being covered everywhere, and people were always talking about the girls. Eddie, however, hello, flop era. His show was canceled. He had to go back to, like, singing at lounges or whatever you do when you're a crooner who's lost some of his success. But DebbieMovesOn.org, and she gets remarried to a nice businessman. Although they do get divorced, like, 13 years later, because he was, like, I guess a gambler and blew all their money. Elizabeth gets bored with Eddie and has an affair with Richard Burton, her Cleopatra co-star, who is sexy. Although, like, Eddie's cute. He was cute. I don't like him one bit, but he was cute. More cute than sexy, though. She has an affair with him, and her and Eddie get divorced after 5 years of marriage. But this one has an ending that is much happier and less bizarre than the last one. Elizabeth and Debbie, they reunite on a cruise ship, of course. Where else are you supposed to find peace in life? They, like, sent each other notes or something at first, and then they shared a meal together where they decided to move on with life. They decided not only to forgive, but also to forget. And then they proceeded to get super drunk. And that was how they became friends again, which is beautiful. Also, in 2001, they were both in New York during 9/11, and Elizabeth let Debbie stay at her hotel uptown. And that same year, they were in I didn't even know that this existed. They were in a TV movie together called These Old Broads that was written by Carrie, where they play actresses that were involved in a love triangle together. That is what I love about Carrie Fisher. One thing about her, she will write some autofiction and you will know exactly what's what and who's who within it. Eddie, on the other hand, bitter. Wrote about Debbie very negatively in his autobiography, and she was like, you know what? I'm not reading that shit. He's the father of my kids. I can't afford to hate him. You know, probably more than she already did. And you know what? When Elizabeth Taylor died, she left some of her jewels to Debbie Reynolds. See, now that's a beautiful story of female friendship. Not only did they get drunk together on a cruise ship, and that was, like, their moment of making peace, but also Elizabeth Taylor bequeathed her jewels to that woman. Okay, last one, I promise. Marlon Brando and Frank Sinatra. This starts in the 50s. Frank Sinatra really wanted the leading role in Guys and Dolls, which MGM was casting for. And the producer did not want Sinatra. And he calls up none other than Mr. Marlon Brando, who says, no, he didn't do musicals because, I mean, first of all, Marlon Brando couldn't really sing or dance. And also, he had that, like, bad boy, I wear a t-shirt and chew on toothpicks and there's, like, dirt on my arm. That was kind of his thing. So he was like, I'm not going to do a goddamn musical. Until, and there are conflicting sources about this, some of them say that the producer of the movie said this. Some of them say, actually, that Cary Grant called him up and said this. Either way, a man told Marlon, I know you don't like Frank. Take the role to piss him off. And Marlon said, you know what? Good point. I don't know why he didn't like Frank in the first place, but whatever. Marlon said, okay, let's do it. As long as he wanted his voice to be dubbed, like Zac Efron in High School Musical, he said, that's what he said. He said, I'm going for that. And you know what else he said? He said, I'm not going to stop till I get my shot. It actually ended up, his voice wasn't dubbed, but it turned out fine because they like did some trickery and cut together multiple takes. So Marlon was the lead and Frank was cast as the second lead. Also, the reason Frank didn't like Marlon, I'm deducing, was because this wasn't the first time Marlon took a role away from Frank. He did On the Waterfront that Frank really wanted to do, and Marlon won an Oscar for it. But they do Guys and Dolls, and Frank Sinatra, he did a lot of acting, but obviously we remember him as a singer. He wasn't, like, as in love with the craft of acting as Marlon was. And Marlon wanted to do take after take after take to get it right. Frank wanted to do one take, whatever, figure something out with it. So Marlon would mess up his lines so they would have to do a bunch of takes in a row. Especially during this one scene where Frank is eating a very rich cake and Marlon just keeps fucking up his line. So Frank just has to keep on chomping away. I remember watching Lemonade Mouth, and a lot of those Disney movies, they would have like a special version of the movie where like fun facts about the movie would pop up on the screen and you'd be like, okay, have fun. And there was one scene where they were eating pizza and Bridget Mendler was like, we had to eat so much pizza because we didn't realize how many takes we were going to be doing. And they call that pulling a Sinatra, or I do. I guess between Lemonade Mouth and Guys and Dolls, I guess that's just what happens in great musical cinema. Now, when Marlon really wronged Frank, because Marlon famously was a slut. By the way, I bought a biography of him, and I need to read it one of these days. Mostly just, I am interested in it. He had a fascinating life. I mean, he wasn't a nice guy, but some very interesting stuff there. He had such an addictive personality, like first with sex and then eventually with food and the, you know, Truman Capote profile that he was like, you made me look fat. Anyway, I need to read that book mostly because it's massive. And I don't know when I'm going to be moving out of my current apartment, but if I do, I'm not packing a biography of Marlon Brando that's the size of the Oxford Dictionary. I refuse. So I guess I'll have to study up. Anyway, the slut Marlon. Frank at the time was married to Ava Gardner, who, by the way, I forget the exact quote, but once she said about Sinatra, he's 120 pounds and half of it is cock. Which I usually would never say that word under really any other circumstances, but because Ava Gardner said it first, I have to say it. Okay, Ava Gardner spent a day on set, not really on set, but in Marlon's dressing room. So, a little bit later, Marlon was, I guess, on a road trip or something. He visited a rest stop and was accosted by three men. And one of those men put a gun out and was like, you have two options. I kill you now. I just put a bullet through you and it's over like that. quick, easy, you're dead. Or you can live, but I'm going to castrate you and carve up your face. And the guys actually ended up doing neither of those things, which was nice of them. And they, like, dropped him off in Hollywood Hills. Dropped him off? What did I say that? Like, they're an Uber? No, they probably, like, didn't even stop the car. Just opened his door and pushed him out. So Marlon hired a bodyguard after that. And he was like, okay, I'm assuming that that was Frank. And honestly, it probably was. Frank Sinatra had allegedly some ties to the mob. Many instances of him canoodling with mob bosses. Or canoodling? Is that romantic or sexual? Probably. He was hanging out with mob bosses. Maybe they were canoodling. I don't know. You never know. Also, the FBI for decades had a file on Frank Sinatra. But to my knowledge, it wasn't as much as I would have thought of, like, him being tied to the mob. It was him, like, initially they thought that he was a draft dodger. Gasp. And then it was he didn't believe in blacklisting communists, and he was affiliated with some anti-racist organizations. So, naturally, the FBI's got to keep some tabs on that. Nothing makes me respect an old Hollywood star like the FBI having a file on them. I think they had one on Marilyn, too. Anyway, the two of them never made up. Okay, that's it. That was Marlon Brando and Frank Sinatra. Those are all the old Hollywood feuds I'd like to discuss today. I hope that's interesting to you guys because I love that shit. So much putting weights in your outfit and Oscar drama. Speaking of the Oscar, I don't know when the Oscars are, but is it just me or are there so many goddamn award shows this year? Have there always been this many award shows in Hollywood? That is so unnecessary, which is one of the few things that I agree with Ricky Gervais on, by the way. I've never watched him on any stage and been like, respect. But when he did the Golden Globes, I was like, yeah, most of these are fair. You should get on stage and tell everyone they have no idea what the world looks like. Because these shows are completely pointless. I mean, I can't imagine like sitting down and watching the entire thing. Although, admittedly, do I get full body chills when I hear a clip of a Jennifer Coolidge acceptance speech? Maybe so. Do I watch those red carpet interviews with Andrew Garfield and that chicken shop girl? And do I feel tingles throughout my body? Many would say I do. Okay? And I'll admit to that. I think award shows are stupid. If I see a clip, I can't guarantee that I won't have a positive response to it. If you don't want me to, don't invite Jennifer Coolidge. I really did think, though, I genuinely thought that, like, a couple years after the beginning of COVID, I don't want to say post-COVID, but you know what I mean by that. Like, once we've gotten adjusted to living in a world with coronavirus, I thought in this world, celebrities would be over. I genuinely believe that. I was like, it's, you know, it's time. They're out. Hollywood's done. And I still kind of believe, I mean, Hollywood is not what it used to be, obviously. These actors just aren't sending the mob after each other like they used to. I thought now that we have so many regular people, like, posting stuff online, people are going to just want to see that. And not want to, like, watch Don't Look Up and read press releases and stuff like that. And admittedly, I was wrong. The second that Imagine video came out with Gal Gadot, or Gal Gadot, I've never heard anybody say her name out loud. No, you know, no offense to her, but I thought as soon as that video was released, this is the beginning of the end. You know, ordinary people are facing so many crises. For once in our lives, we don't want Mark Ruffalo to sing to us. And I never thought I would say that. Maybe like the recession and the cost of living crisis will be the thing. But that completely makes us over celebrities. Or at least that makes us only care about the good, juicy stuff. You know, the good movies, the real scandals, the ridiculous stuff. Not just like, oh, these two celebs were spotted speaking to each other. Give me an Austin Butler faking an Elvis accent for 3 years. That's what I want to see. When did that movie come out? Feels like a decade ago. But celebrities are kind of like a scapegoat for like class issues, which I don't mind at all. It's just that, like, you know, a lot of them aren't that rich, or at least like wealth is not as proportionate to fame as we think it is. Like Julia Fox, super famous right now. Where's the money? Do we really think she has that much income rolling in? I don't think so. But I love her for that. Yeah, we put a lot of blame on celebrities for class issues. But I will say, that isn't the worst thing in the world, because these, like, actual, like, really, really rich people, at least they're quiet, you know? At least they're not trying to give speeches to regular people about what they're doing wrong. Right? I mean, I guess they are, and we're just not listening. We just don't care. I was talking about that. I was on Marlo's podcast recently, who I have to have her back on here soon. But I was talking about this, just the idea of, like, billionaires who want so badly to be famous and, like, have these creative endeavors, like the CEO of Goldman Sachs, who DJs, okay, or the Winklevoss twins trying to start a rock duo. I mean, yes, I saw them live. Yes, I had the time of my life, but that's absurd. And I think it's just because, like, creativity and fame are, like, things that can't really be bought. Like, you can buy publicity, but you can't really make people care. Like, you can put all the stuff out there that you want to. It doesn't mean that anybody's gonna read it or watch it or listen to it. I think for a lot of super rich people, that's, like, the final frontier. It's either space or it's, like, winning a Grammy. And to that I say, just go to space. Okay? Just go to space. Let's keep it simple. Okay, last thing, because I said I would do some recommendations. I've done sort of a regular recommendation thing on here before, and I'll say the same thing now that I said then, which is that I'm not even saying that these are necessarily recommendations, because I'm just going to kind of tell you a couple things that I've consumed this past week. Are they good? Are they not? I'm not even going to make a definitive claim either way. I'm just telling you. I'm not endorsing, and I'm not denouncing. But I'll tell you about the two books I read this week, or the one book and the third of a book that I read this week. First one that I did finish, it's about 100 pages, a short story collection, Pure Hollywood by Christine Schutt. I really liked the titular story. I believe it's the first one. It's about a woman who was married to a much older, kind of creepy has-been comedian, and he dies, and it's just the aftermath of that, and she's with her brother, and they have, like, a weird relationship. All the stories have, like, a lot of pretty crazy events and some twists that are just sort of, like, at the end of a long paragraph and kind of easy to miss. A lot of themes of dreariness, death. The characters have, I don't know how to describe it, it's very, like, sort of this bleak hollowness. Almost like they're not human, but not necessarily in a bad way. Kind of not human in a way that's relatable. You know, you're kind of like, you're not a person, and I get that. I understand. I like the darkness. I like, it's very, very stylistic, and it can be one of those books where the prose kind of gets prioritized above the plot sometimes. Because there were definitely a few times where I had to go back and be like, stunning metaphor, but what the fuck just happened? So I read that. Overall, honestly, could go either way on it. Something I have been very much enjoying, Virtuoso by Yelena Moscovitch. I am only about a third of the way in, but I am enjoying it. Maybe I'll revisit it next time. It's a novel that kind of weaves stories together. Stories about women. Stories about lesbians specifically. And just about the relationships of women to each other, generally, in just stunning, stunning prose. Such a flair, such a style, very much prose that reads like poetry, which I'm very into. The reason I got it was the blurb on the cover. A hint of Lynch, a touch of Ferrante, even though I couldn't really get that into The Lying Life of Adults, but I'm sure it's great. The cruel absurdity of Antonin Artaud, the fierce candor of Anais Nin, the stylist languor of a Lana Del Rey song. I mean, if that doesn't sell you. Not that I'm trying to sell you, but that sold me. That's why I'm reading it. Also, my favorite quote so far, dog-eared, underlined, this one line, "Don't we all ask for death before we learn how to ask for what we really want?" Ugh. Oof. That's so goddamn good. I truly think if people posted that instead of like the suicide hotline, that might be more effective. That's so good. So hopefully I'll finish the remaining 2/3. Time will tell. No, I'm sure I will. That's all for now, folks. Thank you for listening. Again, if you have any ideas or opinions for what you want to hear from the podcast in the future, don't hesitate to DM me. And I will talk to you guys next week. Bye.